What you have lost, I've never found. I lost my nerve, yet peace surrounds. So carry on. And now that all's been said and done, who said it best? Were you the one? Let's just forget, leave it behind, and carry on. Let's just forget, leave it behind, and carry on.
Times for a change. See, the luck I've had can make a good man turn bad. So please, 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 let me, let me, let me, let me get what I want this time. Haven't had a dream in a long time. See, the life I've had can make a good man bad. So for once in my life, let me get what I want. Lord knows it would be the first time. Lord knows it would be the first time.
Hello, everyone. This is Mitch Saunders at 91.5 WMFL Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. Today I'm going to be talking to you about a bunch of stuff going on recently in the political world. I'm going to talk about some special elections that happened recently, some stuff that happened in the Senate elections in Michigan, California, and surprisingly West Virginia. Some circuit court changes that have gone on over the past 2 years, which I think is important to highlight, given that Democrats have kept the Senate in 2022. And, of course, going to talk about the 2024 Republican primary with some new entries and Ron DeSantis still questioning his political future. So, to start off, let's talk about some of those Senate races. So I think a good one to start out with is West Virginia. West Virginia, obviously, we know that Joe Manchin is currently the incumbent for that, for the, what is it, the Class 3 seat? All the seats up are in the third class. And Manchin is not clear whether or not he is running yet. He's stated that he's not running for the governorship, but the Senate is still up for grabs whether or not he wants to run, and I think a lot of that has to depend on who runs in the race themselves. Largely, they're seen as two top contenders, and one of them is Representative Mooney, who is the representative for the northern West Virginia congressional district. It's the first district. And Mooney is seen as the more vulnerable candidate compared to Jim Justice. Jim Justice has a really interesting background. He is currently the sitting governor of West Virginia, and he started out that way, and he got elected in his first term as a Democrat. So, Justice, I believe, was elected in 2016. Yeah, he was elected in 2016. He was elected as a Democrat, which is pretty crazy because in 2016 there was still some semblance of the Democratic Party in West Virginia, though there was really still a very low bar for how Democrats could do. And the fact that Democrats sort of organized there and Justice won that was a really, really big deal, especially because Clinton had lost in the general and in the presidential election, and because the whole state was facing a realignment that had been going on since, you know, before Obama's term. I think it really started in 2000. And the fact that Justice pulled out that win was a really big deal and still sort of proved that there were some remnants of those ancestral coal mining Democrats type people. So he has stated that he'll decide within the next around 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, whether or not he'll be running for the Senate. But recently there was a really big thing that happened. I believe it was yesterday. In that he'll be signing one of the largest, tax cuts for West Virginians ever in the history of the state. And he's sort of, he's lobbied the Republican state Senate and the state House, both of which have Republican supermajorities, so it's not that difficult. But whether or not, you know, the policy makes it through, you know, as we've seen with House Republicans in the U.S. House, that things don't always go to plan even when you hold the majorities. So, yeah. Justice, in some matchup polling, it seems that Manchin is sort of competitive against Mooney, whereas compared to Justice, that's not really the case. Justice is pretty popular in the state, and he's also a pretty unique character. He's conservative, no doubt, and he was a Democrat up until 2017 when he saw that you can't be a Democrat in West Virginia and win, even if you believe in every single thing the Republicans believe in. There's no shot for you to win that. So his policies are a little wonky in that, like, that he's not, you know, a line step conservative or like a bleeding heart conservative, like the governor of Wyoming or South Dakota or Idaho. He's sort of unique in that he was very, very strong on COVID vaccines, getting his people vaccinated. He constantly sent out briefings about that. It was very funny. Some of the videos where he would bring in his dog, which he called Baby Dog, and it was just very funny that he would, you know, have her sitting on the camera with him, and he would make jokes about her and trying to, you know, get people to get vaccinated. It was very funny. It was a good way to do it. And there's some other things like social welfare programs that he is supportive of, sensible gun control legislation, like the one that was passed over the summer in 2022. There's a lot of things that I find to be sort of common sense about him, that he sort of is a Republican for sure, but I see him as more along the lines of Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, maybe a little bit more conservative. And so Manchin, I don't see in any world can win re-election. He didn't even win a majority of the votes in 2018. And I think the fact is that in 2018 it was obviously a very Democratic electorate, but what was outsized was rural voters switching to voting from Republican for Democrat just for that one election, which was even more so than some, you know, urban areas. In West Virginia there was a district that was within 15 points, whereas now all of them are blowouts that are 40. Republicans win the district by 40 plus. So the fact that there was one district that was relatively close when all the districts had the same partisanship, this was in 2018, you can sort of tell that the greater effect was in the rurals, where you just had a lot of reversion to the Democrats just for a sec, not really reversion, I would say. You just have them voting for Democrats for one election because they weren't happy with Trump, wanted to check on Trump type of thing. But that, of course, would not stick and will not stick, as it didn't in 2020 and 2022, and will do so in elections in the future. And so Manchin does not have a path to victory. This is something that he is dead on arrival. There is no world in which he can win that Senate seat and keep the Democratic majority. It does not happen. And it doesn't happen because of the environment. If it was a midterm environment and it was a Republican president like it was in 2018, or it was less polarized and there was still down ballot, a lot of down ballot Democrats in West Virginia like in 2012, this would have been a different story. However, there is no path to victory because Biden's going to lose the state by 40 like he did, or 50, however much he lost it by in 2020, or whatever Democrat that ends up running. West Virginia doesn't have a bench for Democrats. It doesn't have Democratic organization as a party because the only representative there is Manchin himself. And Democrats don't like Manchin. I mean, West Virginia Democrats do. And I think there's a lot of Democrats that appreciate him for his role in keeping the 50-50 Senate and helping Democrats pass a lot of things. But also, he harmed parts of Democratic legislation and discussions of the filibuster and the like. So he is not someone that is beloved by the Democratic Party and wouldn't hate. I think a lot of the Democrats wouldn't hate to see him go down. But ultimately, him going down is the likely odds of Democrats keeping the Senate, which is extremely low as is. So, ticket splitting of 50 points, 40 points, upwards of 40 points doesn't happen in the modern era. It happened last time, it happened was 2012, I would say, for the Democrats, when Obama was super strong and held together those rural and urban coalitions. So, Manchin might decide to retire if he feels that, or if Jim Justice announces that he is going to run. It's very possible that Manchin might just say, I'm going to retire, I don't feel like going through a grueling election. Manchin's relatively young for the Senate. I think he's in his mid-70s or late 60s or something. So he could just decide to do that because he doesn't want to go through the election. And I wonder if Democrats are really trying to recruit him, because he would be a good thing for Democrats, because solely he would require Republicans to spend in West Virginia. If Manchin doesn't run, then Democrats won't spend in West Virginia, and therefore Republicans won't spend in West Virginia. Democrats have a really big map of places they need to defend. They need to defend Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan with an open seat, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada, Montana, and Ohio are two of the biggest ones. So if Republicans have to spend money in West Virginia, that takes away some of the money they are able to spend to book ads in those other states. At the same time, the argument could be said for Democrats that having Manchin run might burn money in a race where he's not meant to win, where if Manchin runs, sure, he'll get close. He might come with maybe questionably within 10 points or maybe 15 points. Realistically, it's like a 15-20 point loss that's bound to happen, because that's how it's happened in 2010 and 2014 with Democratic incumbents in super red states like Arkansas. They've lost by Democratic incumbents in Arkansas in the Senate in 2010 and 2014, both lost by about 17 points. Didn't matter how long they were there. So I don't know if Manchin is going to run. I think if Justice joins in the next 3 weeks, I think he'll say he'll retire. That's by no means guaranteed. I'm interested to see what he will say. But really interesting development about Justice getting the tax break through the state legislature. They cut a deal on that, and that's a big boon to his Senate chances. And from my personal standpoint, I wouldn't hate Jim Justice in the Senate. The idea of someone who was a Democrat as recently as 2016, who has a lot of the right ideas on a lot of issues for a Republican, I think is something that the Senate could benefit from. And while I think Manchin also brings that perspective and he's a better vote, he's not going to win against Jim Justice and he's not going to win against Alex Mooney. And I would much rather the senator from there be someone who is more moderate like Justice than I would Mooney. I also do think that Justice is favored in the electorate if he runs in the primary, because Mooney is only in the first congressional district, whereas he's the whole state, and I believe he's been there longer than Mooney. So, that's West Virginia. What else is going on in the Senate races? So there was some big news out of Montana, which is I would argue to be the second or third most vulnerable Democratic incumbent held seat in the 2024 Senate elections, in that John Tester has decided to run for re-election, which is a really big deal for Democrats. There was an analysis someone had on Twitter that said Democrats keeping the Senate has about a 5% chance without Tester running and a 30% chance with him running. Now, 30% is not it's not odds you want to have, but 5 versus 30, come on. I think it's a little lower. I think that Tester deciding to run for re-election is a big deal, but it's more like 5% to 20%. And the reason why is because it doesn't matter at this stage how long you've held the incumbency for. That seems sort of irrelevant. Largely, it is what is your opponent, what is your Republican opponent like? How much is the president, how much is the top of the ticket going to win or lose the state by? And how much can you recover from that loss of margin if you're John Tester in Montana? Steve Bullock ran for Senate in 2020, right alongside with the presidential ticket. And he ended up, the difference in the state was, I believe, about a 16-point victory for Trump. And Bullock did well, I guess, relatively. I mean, Bullock was the sitting governor at the time, running for Steve Daines' seat, and he lost by 10 points, 55 to 45, whereas the Biden-Trump was like 57-41. So yeah, he made gains upon the Biden margin. He flipped some crucial voters, but it's not enough, because Montana is an R plus 15 state at the minimum. Now, John Tester is a different kind of incumbent. I think Bullock was liked. I mean, Bullock was reelected in 2016 by around 3 points in a Trumpy electorate, when in a more Trump electorate. So I think that goes to show. I mean, I think governor's races have a very different sort of nature than Senate races, in that governors are much more local, and they can be seen by the people in a way that senators who are flying to Washington often don't. And they aren't seen in that way. So Tester running is by no means a bad thing for the Democrats, of course. But again, this is an extremely uphill battle. I think what Democrats would have to hope for is a bad Republican candidate. And thankfully they have them, because Republicans in Montana are okay. There's the state attorney general, I believe his name, don't know first name, but last name is Knudsen, something like that. He's considered a very strong challenge to Tester, that he doesn't really have a lot of political baggage. And the same goes for Governor Gianforte, I don't know how to pronounce that, but Gianforte, Greg Gianforte, that he was a representative and now he is the governor. And he's also seemingly relatively strong. He was the representative before Montana gained its second congressional district in this last redistricting cycle. And he seems like a strong candidate as well. Again, not a lot of baggage. The problem is with the two GOP representatives that Montana has, and that's Matt Rosendale and Ryan Zink, or Zinke. The two representatives, one of them was a major underperformer in 2022, that he didn't even get over 50%. It's the westmost congressional district in Montana. It's a Trump plus, I think, 8 district, and I think it was around a 4-point victory for him, which is really not good for that district, which is probably around an R plus 10 partisan lean in a Republican year. So he's not an electoral performer, and Rosendale is nothing special either. And both of them have political baggage regarding welfare or sort of like some scandals regarding something in the state, but effectively they are not regarded as strong candidates, and in the polling that has showed as well, in one or two polls that firms have put out, is that Knudsen and Rosendale perform far, far stronger than Zinke or Rosendale. Gianforte and Knudsen perform better than Zinke and Rosendale. So if Democrats have a sort of contested primary there, you have 3 or 4 of them running, and you get a GOP representative, that is a big boon to Tester's chances. And the race is definitely a toss-up. But it's a toss-up with, you know, quotes around it, in that if there's no major changes, if there's no bombshell that's sort of going on in 2024, it's going to be a very, very difficult climb for Montana, for John Tester. And it's just because you cannot overcome partisanship. In 2018, Tester did win a majority. He won 50.3%, but that's in 2018. That's a Democratic electorate, and he ended up winning by about 3.5 points, 4 points. That's not enough in a presidential year. That needs to be accentuated, whereas ticket splitting has decreased and continues to decrease every year. So I think there's hope. Definitely there is hope for Democrats now to keep the Senate. But they have one seat to spare. So you lose West Virginia and you need to hold every single Senate seat that's up, plus hold the presidency. And Democrats have been punching above their weight recently in elections. And I'll get into that, because there are some special elections that are kind of shocking about how the Democrats are doing so well. But yeah, they would require not a miracle, but it would require flipping a coin maybe on its head like a bunch of times, something like that. Low odds is what I'm saying. So that's a nice little update in Montana. Good news for the Democrats. And then you have a shadow primary that's sort of going on in Michigan's open Senate race in 2024. Senator Stabenow, who's represented the seat for many terms, I think 3 terms, maybe 2 or 3. I don't know when she was elected. I can find out super quick, though. She was elected in 2000, so she's been there. This is her 4th term. And she was a state, and she was a representative before then. So she decided to retire, which means that there's an open seat in a very competitive year, which is not great for Democrats. But it's also not the worst, because Michigan has proved to be very good for Democrats as a swing state recently. And when I said that there's a sort of a shadow primary going on, a shadow primary is basically when the voters kind of don't get to decide, and it is sort of the individual actors that either lobby to get their opponents, their possible opponents, out of the election as contenders, or that they take themselves out of contention. So there was about a list of, you know, 15, 20 people that the Democratic Party has a very, very deep bench in Michigan, 15, 20 people that they felt were, that had declared possibly being interested. And, there was one front runner whose name was Alyssa Slotkin. She's a representative from the Lansing-based district in Michigan, and Lansing holds, believe it holds MSU, and MSU is recently where there were three students killed by a campus shooter, which is tragic and just unimaginable that it's still happening, and happening more and more, but also something that we live with because there is no real gun control because of a lot of issues and precedent, a lot of Second Amendment abuses, and a lot of Republican gerrymandering and hegemony and control over the past many years, and a congressional system that doesn't work because of the filibuster. That being said, Slotkin represents the Lansing-based district, and she's represented it since 2018. She was a part of the freshman Democratic class in 2018. She's proven to be extremely strong. Her first district started out as like R+6. I believe it was a Trump district, and she flipped it and then held it, not against all odds, but she held it with really a pretty solid margin in 2020. In 2022, she was the Michigan state legislature. No, the Michigan voters approved a ballot initiative that would allow for an independent redistricting commission, and that commission allowed for a far more balanced map. In fact, I believe the most balanced map in the nation. And Slotkin had close, I believe it was a slightly Trump district. I believe it was like Trump plus 0.2. But she was still able to win it by a really strong margin. And she's proven herself electorally. Clearly, she's someone that represents her people well, and that is deservedly holding that seat as an electoral overperformer. So she seemed to be the front runner, but there were also a lot of people in question. And that Slotkin had sort of been prepping for this race. Stabenow, I think, saw her as her heir apparent. And that there were a few other names, though. And it ultimately came down to four names. Mallory McMorrow, who is a Democratic state senator in the state senate, obviously, from Michigan. And she rose to fame by making many statements spoke out against the Republican legislature and trying to push for abortion bans in the legislature and LGBTQ hate legislation, which she spoke out against, and she was sort of picked up by CNN and MSNBC. So she's very popular now, and I believe she will run for higher office sometime in the future. My guess is a 2026 governor run, but right now she's enjoying the Democratic trifecta and running and getting legislation passed in the trifecta. Another two names that were up were the Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson, who won by the largest margin in many election cycles, but the largest margin for a row office in Michigan, or really any office. I think she outpaced Whitmer by 5 points. I mean, she was running against someone who was an election denier and a right-wing nut, who is now leading the Michigan GOP, by the way. Kristen Caramo, who ran against Jocelyn Benson, was elected head of the state GOP in Michigan, which just goes to show how poorly Michigan Republicans have been organizing since the days of Rick Snyder in 2010 and 2014. Rick Snyder was the governor. And the fact that Kristen Caramo was leading the state GOP is hilarious, but that Jocelyn Benson won by such a wide margin. I believe she hasn't formally stated that she is not going to run, but that is sort of the understood path that's going to be taken. And then the lieutenant governor, Gilchrist. I believe Garland Gilchrist is his name, something like that. But I know the last name is Gilchrist. He's the lieutenant governor. He was elected in 2018 with Whitmer, and he decided against running as well. And so basically the field was kind of cleared behind the scenes for Slotkin. I think what parties hate is they hate most intra-party tough primaries. When you have candidates that are both, or many of them are extremely qualified for the position, the claws can come out. Because these politicians are fighting for their life to push forward their political careers. This is not just, you know, something that's, you know, trying to be nice and happy and, oh, Democrats are going to work together to, or Republicans are going to work together to make sure that they win this state. In the primary, that's not the case. It is ruthless. As was seen in the 2020 presidential primary for the Democrats. So having shadow primaries and having people take themselves out on their own, or having discussions with, those, or having discussions with, representatives or people considering running, to make sure that none of that dirty stuff has to be seen by the American public is really good for, how the electorate sees it and coming together on election day. Because if you have a primary that's divided and you've won by, you know, you've won with 30% of the vote and you have three other contenders, you have to consolidate all of those voters, every single one of them, to win in a state like Michigan. So there is one possibility still, in that Representative Brenda Lawrence, who's a representative in Congress from Michigan, has stated that if there was no formidable, or if there was no real African-American candidate that would be running for the seat, she would run for it herself. I don't know if that is still the plan. She'd be running against a fellow representative, Alyssa Slotkin. She might do it just to raise awareness regarding the necessity for black representation in the Senate on the Democratic side. I don't know. We'll see what happens if there is none, or if she feels that Slotkin deserves the nomination, deserves the primary victory. So that's been good, sort of good for Democrats as well, not having to worry about a shadow primary, not having to worry about a real primary by having a shadow primary for the most part. And on the Republican side, there's still a lot of openings regarding who is going to run. There is a Republican State Board of Education individual running, but that is sort of the highest profile Republican that is running for the spot so far. There's been discussion that former Representative Peter Mayer might run. He was representing Michigan's 3rd Congressional District, and he was primaried by the Democrats. He was primaried by his own party, by John Gibbs, with some helpful funding from the Democrats, which I stand by as a good decision, because Democrats ended up winning that seat, whereas Mayer would have held it for as long as he wanted to, and that's a very crucial seat for Democrats taking back the House majority when there is when there are tiny margins. So the Michigan Senate race will be interesting. I guess we'll be watching to see if Brenda Lawrence is going to jump in. And Slotkin right now seemingly has the primary, if not. And then in California, the California Senate race that no one wanted to happen as an open race in 2024, when Democrats need to defend every Senate seat under the sun. You have Democrats, Adam Schiff, Katie Porter, and Barbara Lee, who seem to be the three front runners, running for this seat in a way that is just going to siphon off so much money from other races, because the Democratic voters are not the most intelligent in what they should be putting their money towards, and Democratic fundraising emails by Katie Porter and Adam Schiff are especially good because they hit at the MSNBC. The MSNBC individuals, the MSNBC parents, the people who say, oh, I like Katie Porter, oh, I like Adam Schiff, let me donate to them. When really, all that money should be going to John Tester, because he's the one that's going to keep your Senate majority, not Katie Porter. And in that race, those three, it seems as though Schiff has the edge right now. The primary isn't for another, you know, year and change. But Barbara Lee, who is, she's 76. She's African American, and she is, I believe, the first person of color to run for that seat in this race. So she is from Northern California, whereas you have Schiff and Porter, who are from Southern California. Schiff came, his rise to fame came in the, as he was the main impeachment manager for Trump's first impeachment trial. And Katie Porter was a freshman Democrat in the 2018 class. Her seat has become increasingly safe in recent years, and she was well known for using a whiteboard and sort of taking down CEOs regarding their payment of their staff or sort of exploiting their workers, stuff like that. So she sort of became a star of the left-wing media. And so you have Schiff and Porter that are really going to be duking it out. It seems as though Barbara Lee is not as not as contentious for this seat, though there's still a lot that can happen. And it is a jungle primary. So the top two vote-getters will go to the general election. I discussed last time that if Republicans get two really strong candidates, they could, in theory, box out the, you know, 10 Democratic candidates that are running for this seat, which would be crazy. But not the most insane thing that's happened in politics. My bet and my preference would be Adam Schiff. Based on what I've heard about Katie Porter working on the Hill, she's not the best individual. She's not very nice, from what I've heard. So I think that Schiff would be in a good spot to win. I think I would prefer Schiff to win, but we'll see what will happen. So that's sort of the major Senate race updates. Bob Casey in Pennsylvania, who is the incumbent Democrat, is running for re-election. He recently underwent surgery for prostate cancer, which seemingly went well, and he is in recovery doing well. John Fetterman, who was recently elected, of course, was admitted to the hospital, or self-admitted to the hospital for severe depression, which I believe he's getting treated for at Walter Reed. Which is, you know, good that he is able to publicize that in a way to destigmatize and to help destigmatize depression as something real and something that millions of Americans are facing every day. So kudos to him for that, and I hope that he gets the support that he needs. In other competitive election talk for the Senate, most of the races haven't really quite shaken out yet. And who's going to run in Arizona? Carrie Lake, who recently lost the governor's race to Katie Hobbs by about 0.3. She's an election denier. She is heavily considering running for that Senate race against Kyrsten Sinema and Ruben Gallego. Kyrsten Sinema has not decided whether or not hasn't decided whether or not she is running. Many speculate she is not running. So that's the Senate. That only took up 40 minutes of my time on this. I guess I'll have to talk about some stuff next time. But what I'd like to just highlight before going into some special elections that happened recently is the shift in circuit court balance. So in the U.S., there are 13 circuit courts. They are made up of, 11 of them are made up of various geographical regions designated by state. So some of them, and they're not really balanced in population. They should be redrawn to be more equal in population, but they haven't been in years. And that there are, some of them have, you know, a bunch of states: California, Washington, Oregon, Montana, Arizona, and others have just a handful of states, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. That's the third district. And the Eighth Circuit, has Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, and Arkansas. So there's kind of an imbalance in population of these circuits, and that's just because they haven't been redrawn in so long. But there's been a shift in a lot of balance of these circuit courts since Democrats and Biden have taken office in 2020, and the composition of these courts will continue to shift. But the reason why these circuit courts are so important is that is because they're just below the Supreme Court, and they have a lot of final say on many rulings that have, you know, that shouldn't be relegated to the Supreme Court as they've decided, unless, you know, there are appeals, and either Democrats or Republicans appeal in the way they see fit. But the partisan composition of these circuit courts is crucial because when Trump came in with McConnell over his 4-year term, it was a major shift of the partisanship of judges nationally. McConnell had held open all of the judicial nominations that Barack Obama had put forward from 2015 and 2016, and made sure that Trump was able to fill them from 2017 to 2020, and continued to fill them. So not only it was not really 4 years of confirmations, it was like 6 years packed into 4 years, which was a really big deal. And Republicans ended up flipping a lot of these circuits. So there's 11 circuits, and then there's two more circuits that are relegated specifically to DC, and then the federal circuit. So the DC circuit is the one that is just below the Supreme Court. That's the one like second in line to the Supreme Court. And so of these 11, there have been three that have changed recently. So Republicans ended up flipping the second district, which makes up New York, Vermont, and Connecticut, the third circuit, which makes up Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, and the 10th circuit they divided. So instead of it being a majority of Democratic nominees, it was an even number of judges from both Republican and Democratic presidents. During Biden's term, Democrats have flipped back the 10th, flipped the 2nd, and divided the 3rd, which is a really, really big deal, because Democrats now control in total 7 of these circuits. Republicans control 4, and one of them is split. Or no, Republicans control 5, and one of them is split. And so that wasn't the case before. The Fifth Circuit you'll hear from, and they have some of the most conservative rulings that are, you know, beyond what the Constitution will even allow for. Just ruling however they see fit in whatever extremely right-wing ideological way they'd like to. The Fifth Circuit is like one of the most conservative ones, and it has Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, and it's one of the most conservative circuits nationally. It is the most conservative, I would argue. And these circuits are not based on partisanship. Like, it's not necessarily that there are Democratic areas that have Democratic judges. It's just the way that stuff aligned. West Virginia is represented by, or not represented, West Virginia is in the Fourth Circuit, which is held by a majority of Democratic appointees, whereas Illinois is in the 7th, and the 7th has a majority of Republican presidential nominees, appointees. So the fact that Democrats flipped that is a really big deal, and a big testament to Democrats keeping the Senate in 2022, and their continual pumping out of judges. So props to them for that. And in the last 15 minutes, what I want to do is go through the recent special elections that happened last Tuesday. The big one being the, which I went through last time, the state Supreme Court election in Wisconsin. And obviously, we know Wisconsin is a very contentious state. Trump won it by 0.3, Biden won it by 0.6. It has always been close, unless your name is Barack Obama. Who can win it by seemingly 10 points. But, I digress. The special election, the primary, the jungle primary for that quote-unquote nonpartisan office happened. And the four candidates I can remind you of were Judge Janet Protasiewicz, Judge Jennifer Doro, Judge Justice Daniel Kelly, and Judge Everett Michael. Protasiewicz is a judge from Milwaukee. Everett Michael is a judge from Dane County, from Madison. Justice Daniel Kelly was a justice on the state Supreme Court from 2016 to 2020. And Jennifer Doro is a Waukesha judge. So what ended up happening was that Janet Protasiewicz, who is the leading candidate on the liberal side, and this, again, this election makes up the, it decides the composition of the state Supreme Court, whether or not liberals flip it or whether conservatives hold it. So Protasiewicz ended up winning 46.5% of the vote, which is a really, really big margin. I mean, that's almost half the vote with three other candidates running. So a very good sign for Democrats and liberals heading into the general election is April 4th. You had her win 46.5% of the vote, and Judge Everett Michael wins 7.5%. He was seen as the more progressive of the two. And then for the conservatives, it was a really close race, like a nail biter. And it was Justice Kelly that ended up winning with 24.5% or something like that. It was like 24.3% to Judge Doro, who received about 21.5%. So only about a 3% difference between these two. And it was sort of a nail biter. The edge was given to Kelly early on, and he maintained it. And Kelly had, where Kelly got his support from was the rural areas. He was smashing Doro in those areas, basically everywhere outside of Dane County, Milwaukee, and the Wow counties, Washington, Ozaukee, and Waukesha, which surround Milwaukee. Those were obviously, because Doro is from Waukesha, she performed better in those three, much better than Kelly, and that's where she got her support from, and those are very populous. But the turnout for conservatives was kind of anemic, especially in the like driftless area in the northern rurals. It was really, really bad. The reason why Kelly won was because he got Assad type margins, you know. He over Doro in those conservative, in the northern, basically in all the rural areas. But turnout was not good for Republicans. Turnout was okay in the Wow counties, but that was because you had Doro on the ticket, and Doro was widely supported by those suburban Republicans. So in total, those two made up less of the vote than Protasiewicz as one candidate. That's a big deal. And the fact is that liberals ended up getting 54% of the vote to conservatives 46. Now, primary electorates don't really mean anything in Wisconsin state Supreme Court elections. In 2020, when Justice Dan Kelly was running against Jill Karofsky, the liberal, the primary had brought Kelly over 50%. Now, it's still a top two regardless of whether or not you get a majority, but Kelly got just over 50%, and Karofsky got 35%. Fast forward to the primary a month and a half later, and Karofsky ended up with 55% of the vote, and Kelly ended up with 45% of the vote. So the primary electorate is not the same as the general electorate, and I think Democrats should be cautious to forget that. That being said, Protasiewicz doesn't need much more support to get to 50%. There will be more voters in the general election, however. But what was I going to say? Something about turnout. Yeah, turnout was really high. This was the highest level of turnout for a state Supreme Court primary in the last 10, 15 years as far as it's recorded. So it's the highest ever. It almost eclipsed 1 million voters. million voters in a weird off-year election. Democrats are turning out at a crazy rate. I don't know why exactly Democrats are turning out so strongly for elections recently. I think that 2022 really opened a lot of people's eyes. The Democratic electorate is now more educated and more wealthy. It's suburban-based. It's suburban-based. So you have that, those people that always know when it's time to vote. And that's sort of why the rural turnout was so bad for conservatives, and that's why they got less than the liberals, I would say, because there was no one at the top of the ticket to drive them out. And Democrats just are aware of when the elections are happening because they are, at large, more college-educated now. That was the Republican Party 10 years ago. The party of Romney was the college-educated suburban party, and now it is the Democratic Party. Because of a lot of far-right wingism and a lot of election denialism. So, Democrats turning out at this rate is really good, a really good sign for April 4th, which is the general. And I think that the prognosticators are saying that Protasiewicz definitely has the edge on Kelly. Kelly has to consolidate all of the support from Doro and then gain some more. Protasiewicz doesn't need that much more support to win. Everett Mitchell, his supporters are likely to go to Protasiewicz. His support largely came from Dane County, which is where he's from. And this is an off-year election, but it seems like Democrats are turning out at a really high rate, whereas Republicans are not aware of these elections going on in the rural areas. So the suburbanites in the WOW counties might turn out for Kelly, but Kelly was also seen as the less electable general election candidate. People wanted, or at least people in, you know, political punditry circles or people who were not directly involved in the voting themselves wanted Doro, because Doro was a lot more moderate, and she was someone who could drive turnout in the WOW counties. And the WOW counties are where the Republican margins make or break. So unfortunate for them, Justice Kelly ran. You'd think that Kelly won. You'd think that having a former justice would be good, but he just lost. He just lost in 2020. Now, that doesn't mean anything necessarily, but it's proven that he's not a great candidate and that he is a little bit more far right than people are looking for, and Doro was not that. But Doro wasn't really as prepared, and in the primary debate, she was, you know, reading out of a binder, like really not like Kelly. Kelly was consistently attacking Protasiewicz, and I guess people took to that, even though the margin that Kelly won by was not by any means commanding. So it looks good for Democrats. If Democrats, liberals flip the court, that's redrawing the state legislature. It's getting a lot of, it's getting the abortion ban reversed. There's an abortion ban in Wisconsin that's dated from 1849. It'd be a boon to democracy in the United States. In Wisconsin, where it is not a democracy, basically the Republicans have a grapple hold over every single, you know, lever of power, other than the governor's mansion, who really just holds a veto, and Republicans are likely to regain their state Senate supermajority, given that the more moderate Republican won the primary for that state Senate seat. And that means that they can impeach officials that Evers have put in place, or judges that Evers has put in place, which is really bad. So this state Supreme Court election is going to be a big deal. And Protasiewicz has the edge, and that should be appreciated by Democrats nationally. It's a big deal. It's a really, really big deal. So there's also been a few special elections other than that, and there were a few on Tuesday. The major ones, there was a flip, actually. There was actually, weirdly enough, a flip in the New Hampshire State House in a Rochester-based district. A Democrat, the Democrat and the Republican in 2022 in the general election tied, with 970 votes. And now New Hampshire has the largest citizen legislature, largest citizen legislature nationally, but it has the second largest legislature nationally. So citizen legislature means that these representatives are not really paid. They're paid like $100 a year. So they have to do other things. But it's a huge chamber of 400 people. It's completely unwieldy. And Democrats made gains in the chamber after Republicans gained it in 2020, but they couldn't quite take back the chamber. And Republicans were left with like a 202 to 198 majority, which is really, really hard to govern. And Republicans have a trifecta in New Hampshire, which is odd considering that they elected Democrats at every single congressional level for the Senate and both representatives, but also Republicans gerrymandered the state Senate map so that you would need to win a, you know, Trump plus 10 district to win a majority, for Democrats to win the majority in the state Senate. Whereas in the House, it's a little bit harder to gerrymander because there are so many seats. But it was pretty wild that, that this chamber is so close. And Democrats ended up flipping another seat, making their majority 201 to 199. Democrats just passed a bill They passed a bill on the on labor rights on the House floor with a 177 to 167 majority. Democrats had a functioning majority to pass legislation that they wanted to. Of course, it won't really pass because they have the Republican governor and the Republican state Senate. But the fact that Republicans didn't have the people there and Democrats were able to just pass their bill and have a functioning majority without even having the numbers elected to the chamber is wild. So a two-seat majority, or it's really just one seat, a one-seat majority in a state legislature that big is basically meaningless. And it's just crazy what's going on up there. But, you know, Democrats ended up flipping that seat, which is a Democratic overperformance. In Virginia, there was a special election to fill Don McEachin's seat. Don McEachin was a representative for many years. He represented the Richmond-based area. Hold on, I'm just going to pull up the race. Okay, I can't find it. But anyway, Don McEachin ended up passing away. Suddenly, I believe it's the Richmond-based district, and it's a very blue district. It's like D plus 30. And McEachin was beloved by his district and beloved by the Virginia Democrats. And in the primary, voters ended up choosing Jennifer McClellan she's a state senator, to be the first African-American female to represent Virginia in Congress, which is really cool. And not only did she won by outpacing, like, Biden and McEachin numbers. I mean, she overperformed in the district by, like, 5-6 points. And what was so crazy was that this is, you know, it's a heavily minority-based district, and minority voters turned out. And then you had a special election in Kentucky. That where Democrats overperformed with white working class voters. You had Wisconsin, where Democrats turned out. It's just like every single special election has been working out in a way where Democrats are able to consolidate minority and get minority turnout and get college educated turnout and even grab some of those white working class non-college educated voters. It seems like everything is in place for Democrats to do what they need to do on April 4th in the Wisconsin Supreme Court election, in November for the Virginia State Senate and State House elections, which are going, and in New Jersey as well for the State House and State Senate elections. It's going to be a big deal to see what 2024 is like, and as of right now, Democrats are set up to sweep them, which is shocking because it's an incumbent Democrat. I mean, a lot could change in this time. But it's clear that there is an edge that the Democrats have. They're doing something right. And I'm always the Democratic skeptic. I think the Democrats are not doing well, that they weren't organizing basically up until 2022. And then suddenly something changed. And maybe it's the election denialism and the far rightism on the right. Maybe it's Democrats organizing better. And I think 2024 and 2023 we'll see if Democrats can maintain this momentum. But something is going really, really right. So I got to end with 20 seconds with a PSA. This is Mitch Saunders. You're listening to 91.5 WMFO, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Did you know 91.5 FM is college and community radio no matter where you are in eastern Massachusetts? If you're driving northeast from Tufts, check out some underground radio over at WUML in Lowell, broadcasting from UMass Lowell. If you're driving southeast, tune in to hear lots of great programming over at WZLY in Wellesley, broadcasting from Wellesley College.